Our speaker tonight is Dan. He comes from Lancaster, and his home group is From the Heart. Please help me welcome Dan.
My name is Dan Hamilton. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dan.
And my sobriety date is January 30th of 2006. And my home group is From the Heart Speakers Group. Meets in Lancaster on Wednesday nights, 8 o'clock. All are welcome. It's a great group. Very similar to this, lots of happy faces, and this is awesome. I never spoke outside, and it's beautiful, lots of people, this is good. But I pray before I start just because, you know, I have no idea, you know, I feel completely unqualified to do stuff like this, and just like thinking about, you know, all of these people come out to listen to a guy like me talk for an hour just blows my mind. So I ask God, you know, to use me as he sees fit, because I sure as hell don't know. But, you know, what I do and what, you know, I have a sponsor, by the way, who showed me how to do these 12 steps and apply them to my life and pass them on. And my directions when doing stuff like this was to basically just share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And so that's what I do. You know, when I say I'm alcoholic, a lot of times when I was, you know, before I got sober, you know, I had all these different perceptions and ideas of what it meant to be alcoholic, and what that looked like, and the types of things were like all external, you know, as far as what they would physically look like, how much or how little they drank, what they had materially, what substances they used, like these kinds of things. And when I say I'm alcoholic, I'm talking about the stuff that goes on the inside. And I'm, you know, I'm definitely the alcoholic they describe in the big book. But, you know, I do have a lot of other stuff in my story. You know, I did it all. But, you know, once I sat down with my sponsor and he started taking me through the doctor's opinion and through the rest of the big book and showed me what it meant to be alcoholic, and I just couldn't believe like that. The person they were describing in there was me, you know. And at that point I felt like I was home in AA. But to back up, you know, way before I ever picked up a drink, I had a lot of that internal stuff going on. And I was an odd kid. You know, I did all kinds of stuff. I intuitively knew how to lie, how to manipulate situations. You know, I went to school and they taught me how to do math and write and all these kinds of things, but they never told me how to lie and to cheat and to steal. I just knew how to do it, and it came very naturally. You know, if I was somewhere and I was having fun and it was time to go, I would just throw my mom's keys on the roof or just hide them somewhere until I was ready to go, and then I'd tell her where they were. And you know, what I was doing and what I wanted to do was like the most important thing to me. And I just kind of, you know, that selfishness and self-centeredness was always there. I also, like, you know, they had me like going to like all kinds of different like counselors and that kind of stuff, because I was just always acting up and causing trouble, getting in fights, not listening to people, and would just do stupid things, you know, just like my best friend lives right up the street, and before school we would just like hang out for a few minutes every day, and the one morning before the bus came, you know, we were playing with fire, and when I got back, you know, when we got off the bus, his kitchen had pretty much burned down, and so I wasn't allowed up there anymore, of course, you know, but I mean, he was my best friend, and I would just go up there anyway, and I just wouldn't, like, I would just try and, you know, get up there when his mom wasn't around, the one time she came home early, and I went out the back door, but walked right past the window. I didn't duck or anything, so she saw me, and she like went out the front door, and she's like, "What are you doing here? You know you're not allowed here." And this is like, this doesn't make me alcoholic, but this just like is a great picture of like my thinking, you know, and drunk or sober, you know, when the truth would have been more than sufficient, you know, she would have just sent me home. I could have said, I'm sorry, I broke your rules, and she would have sent me home. But instead, this is what I came up with without even a thought. Someone broke into my house, and I got scared and ran up to her house to use the phone. I don't know where that comes from, so then she's like, all right, did you call the police?
Nope.
Did you call your mom? No. So she calls my mom, who calls the police, and then I'm at home, and then the police show up at my house. And once again, the truth would be more than sufficient at this point, but I just take it further. Like, I'm giving the police, like, an M.O., like, a description, all these things. Who I think it might be. I didn't like this kid Sam on my baseball team, so I told him it might be his dad. And these things are just coming and coming. And I don't know, like, looking back, I just think, like, man. And eventually, I think that they knew that I was lying. I probably wasn't that great of a liar, but, they entertained my stories for a little while, and then they were, like, giving me the guilt trip and, like, the scare tactics, like, the detectives are going to come and dust for fingerprints or something, and then they were telling me the consequences of lying to a cop. So eventually, after, like, an hour, I told them the truth. And I just remember, like, looking at my mom, and she was just, like, looking at me like, what is wrong with you? And I didn't know, and I just felt like that is my thinking, like, in a nutshell. That's just how it goes, And I continued to play with fire and burn the woods down, and then the chief of, the fire chief would come, and we'd have to watch arson videos together, VHS. And I was getting in trouble in school, and I never really for as long as I can remember being like aware of self and like what other people might be thinking of me, that consumed a lot of my thought life and a lot of nights staying up like worried about that kind of stuff, and then, they got me on the different pills. So then I was just up like, all night, spinning in my own bed. And I just remember, like at that time, I didn't know these things were, like, narcotic of sorts. And I would just tell my mom, like, I don't feel right. But it was just nuts. And I definitely, looking back, I had all that stuff going on that today I can put words on. But back then, it was just my life, and I didn't know anything different other than something just wasn't right, today I call it an emptiness in my soul. That's feeling like, just not comfortable with my own life and just consumed with fear. And that's the type of kid I was. My first drink, it wasn't planned, it wasn't like, the way I knew what drinking did to people. My neighbor, he drank a lot, and he would get drunk and, like, accidentally shoot me with Roman candles or stuff like that. And he always seemed like he had a good time, and he never knew, like, what time it was. He looked like he was having a good time, and I associated drinking with that. So it was. I had a friend staying the night, and we were just like hanging out, playing video games or whatever. And then I went to the fridge for a drink, and this bottle of wine, like, never used to catch my eye, but for some reason this night it caught my eye. It was a bottle of like Korbel, I think it was called. My sister's dad had bought it from my mom like years ago, so I just figured it was up for grabs, after a certain period of time. So I took it, and we split it, and he didn't like the taste, and I just, like, I loved it. I loved everything about it. This is how profound of a night I had. I cut that cork in half and told him, like, you must save this, and I saved that, my half a cork. Like, I just had, like, that great of a night. I mean, that's a pretty telltale sign if you ask me, but I had a great time. I was, like, I knew, like, this was a landmark in my life. I just, like, I'm going to keep this half a cork because this is a big deal in my life, it's just because, like, he didn't get drunk because he didn't drink enough. He didn't like the taste, and I drank his half too, and I got drunk. But, you know, for the first time, you know, since I can remember, all of those fears dropped from me. I wasn't worried about what anyone was thinking about me. And it sounds so cliche, and I hear it in everyone's story, and they describe what alcohol does for them. And that's definitely my experience. It was just like, you know, one of many times in my life where I just thought, man, I always want to feel like this. You know, and from there, you know, there wasn't any conscious decisions made to become an alcoholic that night. And, you know, I don't remember my second drink, for that matter, or the second time I got drunk. But, you know, for that particular night, I remember what I was wearing. I remember these big gorilla slippers I had on and how, like, ridiculously funny I thought they were. And I was trying to walk a straight line in them, and it was just, like, craziness. And then we prank called, like, a cab driver. But I accidentally gave him my own address. So then we're worried about this guy showing up. So we have all the lights out and we're peeking out the windows, which is kind of funny because later on I end up peeking out of a lot of windows. I was doing that on my first drink. You know, I was into, like, sports, and I was into, like, you know, getting good grades and going to a good college and doing all that kind of stuff. And you know, football, baseball, bowling, But slowly I just started hanging out with different people and doing different things and staying up way too late, not showing up for school. They started calling my mom, and she's like, I can't get him out of bed. I would just tell her to, like, F off. And so then the school district I was in had a school cop. And, you know, so he would show up at my house. I remember the one, like, morning, my mom had left, and I was like, thank God, I can go back to sleep. And not even an hour later, I hear, like, this guy's voice. And, you know, he's waking me up, and I open up my eyes, and it's like Officer Hottenstein from our school district. And he escorts me to school. And that became pretty frequent. And the thing is, like, when you don't go to school, you can't participate in, you know, the football game that night or the baseball game that night if you're not in school. So I was just missing games, missing practice, and slowly just decided, like, I'd rather be doing other things. My grades went down. My alcohol and drug history is relatively short. You know, I went down pretty fast, pretty hard. And I got sober when I was 19, but in, like, the summer between my freshman year and sophomore year, I went to, it just got real bad in my mom's house, and I would blame it on, like, her current boyfriend, or blame it on her, or blame it on anything but my own self, but really, like, the insanity that was going on was a direct result of my drinking and everything else that was going on and all the people that go along with that. And, you know, stuff's missing from the house, things are getting broken, you know, people are staying over there for days and weeks. So I eventually moved to my dad's house across town. Not, you know, wasn't, like, really running from anything other than just wanted, like, it was that feeling of impending doom, really, is what it was. You know, it just wasn't going well, and I could feel it. And I moved over there, and I decided I was going to keep it cool for a while. But for a guy like me to start, you know, new school, don't know anybody, consumed with fear, not drinking, oh my God, that first day of school was just, like, anxiety, like, worried about, like, and then I get on the bus and there's no seats and I got to sit next to that guy that no one wants to sit next to, and, you know, what is that girl thinking about me because I'm sitting next to the guy that's, like, wiping boogers on the windshield. And these are the things that I'm thinking about, and she doesn't even, you know I exist, but, you know, I'm just consumed with what everyone's thinking about me, and then I go into school and, like, you know, wondering, like, what everyone's thinking about what I'm wearing, and it's just, like, it just goes and goes and goes and goes, and you know, eventually I find the same kind of crew at that school, and slowly get back into what I like to do, you know, different people, different house, same stuff, get a girlfriend, get a job, and you know, it got even worse there. And I started doing a lot of things that, you know, I never really thought that I would do. I skipped over a lot of the good stuff, you know, the good times, because everyone had, like, the good times drinking. And I definitely, you know, not the exception. I had a lot of fun. And I guess, you know, the summer after my junior year, I started getting in trouble with the law. And, you know, they would see people getting out of my car that they, you know, knew by on a first-name basis, and they would pull me over and ask me why so-and-so is in your car. And then they would do the search, and then, you know, I'd get charges for what they would find. And then I'd be on probation, and that happened twice. I got caught twice doing stuff like that, and I don't know. I really didn't want to pay more consequences. I would try and stop doing the things that they were, you know, getting me in trouble. I couldn't give the PO a clean urine to save my life. And so my senior year, they had about enough of me, and I went to my first rehab halfway through my senior year, and it was crazy to me, because I really thought, at that point in time, I really thought that my problem was the drugs. You know, I didn't think I had any problem with drinking. And the 12 steps, you know, with that kind of thinking, like, I had no idea what my problem was and what the solution to my problem was at all. And the 12 steps surely didn't look like, they looked like 12 steps to becoming a better human being. And that seemed great to me, but it was like, what about all this stuff that I got going on right now? Like, maybe I'll decide to, like, become a better human being later, but what about all this, you know? How does this fix me? You know, it just didn't make any sense. And so I didn't get a sponsor. I showed up for a couple meetings because I was chasing this girl that I met in rehab, and then I didn't say she was married, so it didn't work out. Well, it worked out, but not really. So I didn't stay sober, you know, and it became very obvious to my dad, and he pretty much said, You gotta get out of here. You know, I keep stealing stuff. My stepmom's trying to, like, have her kids, you know, come stay with her, and, you know, it's just bad. So I move out, just go to my mom's house for a little bit, but I end up back in another rehab, and that's kind of like, you know, nothing different. I went to the same rehab once, and then I decided that it was, you know, it was the rehab. So I went to this one out near Altoona. And you know, I started to do pretty well at these places. After you go to a couple, you know what to expect, you know what to say, you know what to do. And I would always, you know, every time I would go back out, I would smash some more ideas. After a while, I knew that I was powerless. But the worst is you know. Because they would ask me to write letters to myself that I could read if I really wanted to drink, so I could remember what it used to be like. And you know, maybe that works, like, sometimes in the beginning, but after a while, I either just don't care, or it's just like, yeah, that sucked, but being sober is even worse. Just being a prisoner of my own mind. Every time I would get sober, it would just be like, it would be good for a little while. It would be, I would get physically better, I could keep some money in my pocket. Everyone on the outside, everyone says, like, it's looking pretty good, but on the inside, I'm dying. And it's in that condition that mental obsession starts for me. And, you know, at first it's just like, yeah, but, you know what happened. And after a while, it's like, I don't really care. Like, I know where it's going to take me, but I need some relief or I'm going to blow my brains out. And that's where I was at a bunch of times. And I would go pick back up. I went to went to that other rehab, and the only thing that I left there with was this idea, because every time they would close a meeting, they would say not to quit before the miracle happens. And so I would just, I took that as, if I just show up at meetings, and by show up at meetings, like, this is what I would do. I would just go, I would get some coffee, I would fellowship a little bit, check out the girls, and leave. And that was my program of action in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just really thought, like, what they were saying was, if I would hang on long enough, eventually that would start working. And like eventually that mental obsession goes away, that emptiness that I can't, you know, put my finger on or explain will just disappear. And once I'm a few months sober, I'll just be happy and content with my life and the world around me, and things will be good. But it just never happened. I went to a halfway house after that, and they had all their rules and structure for the first month, but then after that they set you free and tell you to go get a job. And I got a job, and I'm walking around with this mental obsession, and I'm fighting it. I'm hanging on for dear life, thinking that eventually this is going to subside, and I don't want to quit before the miracle happens. And so I'm showing up at meetings, I'm following the rules at the halfway house for the most part, and showing up at work, and I wake up 59 days clean, and I give in. I've had enough, and I'm going to go get what I want to get. And once again, it's just like a breath of fresh air. It's a relief from my own self. And of course, the next day, I had gotten a sponsor, by the way, and he told me to do 90 meetings in 90 days, and after we're done with that, we're going to work on some steps. And that sounded fine with me. And so, it didn't work. It didn't work. Just showing up at meetings did not work for me, ever. And that guy didn't stay sober either. But of course, my ego would not allow me to tell you guys that I just relapsed. So the next day I show up wasted at an AA meeting and get my 2 month shift and slowly trickle away from AA. And that was the last time I picked up. That was not the last time I picked up, but the last time I relapsed. And I got kicked out of the halfway house, and they put a warrant out for my arrest because I was on probation, and I got whatever they call it. I got discharged without whatever they call it. So then I was on the run. I wasn't welcome at my mom's house. I wasn't welcome at my dad's house. The girlfriend that I had been with for, a couple of years, she didn't really want anything to do with me. I had my car, but 9 times out of 10, a drug dealer was driving it. So, and it kept getting colder. I had nowhere to go. And all that stuff that I was describing that alcohol did for me when I first drank, none of that was going. None of that was going on. I was doing massive amounts of a lot of things and still wanted to die. It definitely wasn't like I woke up and went and got drunk and said, man, I want to feel like this all the time. I was getting up, getting drunk and thinking, man, I just want to die. And that's not what it was like when I first started drinking. And it's not really what I signed up for, but I chased it to that point. And that's pretty much the condition I was in when I got sober. I called my probation officer and tried to convince him that I was just going to go to another rehab. And he said, you're going to jail. So, I think, if I heard that news today, I'd be pretty upset, and I'd be worried about, what about, texting on my cell phone and my car and my job and all these kinds of things. And at that point, I was just like, whatever. I had absolutely nothing in my life. Nothing. I really didn't feel like anything was being taken from me when, there was nothing on either side of that prison wall that I wanted. And kind of like in the back of my head, I knew that as soon as those cuffs were going to go on me, that there was going to be a break from this. Because the things that I was doing every day to get what I wanted to get was just like crazy. And I was out there committing all kinds of crimes I just never thought I would be doing. And so that was the condition I was in when I got sober on January 30th of 2006. And nothing was different. It's kind of ironic that I went through all these outpatients, inpatients, rehabs, detoxes, halfway houses, counseling, all of these maintenance programs that they have with all these different chemicals to keep me from doing this stuff, and then I end up getting sober in Lancaster County Prison. But nothing was different. I was still absolutely miserable. And thinking about all of the things that I wanted to do when I got out, thinking about how I was going to manage my life differently, and what I needed to do and what I needed to get to make myself happy and to be successful. And it always started with fixing up the outside. And when I got out, I didn't have any money. I went and got my car from the drug dealer. I went up and I went to the gas station, filled up my tank of gas, and left. And went to some other stores and stole some clothes. And I'm just like, fixing up the outside. And it's crazy to me because I'd just gotten out of jail and I was doing all this stuff sober, you know. I remember one of my friends was like saying, like, he just like, I forget what the conversation was, but you know, I didn't just end up like here in a shirt and tie, you know, behind the podium. Like I was nuts when I first got sober. I remember telling my sponsor, like, I just cannot stop stealing gas. I just can't. Like I'm good at it. I get away with it, and I don't have a lot of money, and you know, it's just like my harms list is getting longer. But yeah, I was crazy, so I got out and I did all that kind of stuff, and I went and made right with the girlfriend, and got a job, which I didn't show up for like a few days straight. So I told them they locked me up for another couple days, and they let me back, and then I slept in another 5 days, and they said you can't come back. And then, you know, so that I was just a mess still, and I was like a couple months sober. But I came back today for no other reason than to show you guys how well I was doing. Like, because I could never stay sober. And it was always like, God, like, they're probably all talking about me, you know, at their meetings now because I can't stay sober, and they're probably making fun of me. I don't know. So I had like been sober for a few months because I was in prison. So I wanted to go and get my chips so everyone could see that like Dan Hamilton's sober. And my experiences, my own ego drove me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's been my experience that it doesn't matter what gets us here. You know, that's definitely not going to keep me here. One more sobriety chip is like not going to keep me here. But it's what got me here. And by pure accident, I ran into a guy that knew a lot of more about me than I knew about myself. I went to a meeting on a Saturday night, and it was a normally open discussion. I guess once a month, or if there's a fifth Saturday or something, they had a speaker, and they had this guy show up there and tell his story. And I, you know, it's probably a combination of me finally being in the right place at the right time, and also me open to someone else's ideas. But I would just remember I showed up there with this guy I graduated with. He was just kind of like not drinking and working, and we were both pretty miserable. And we, at the end of that meeting, we both decided this is the best meeting we've ever been to. And you know, I felt like it was just me and this guy speaking. And like in the room, just me and him, and like him with a megaphone, like screaming on my heart. You know, it's just like exactly what it felt like. He was telling, they say like you eventually hear someone tell your story, and his external story is a lot different from my external story. But he started talking about my internal life and what it felt like to be sober and without a solution. And he was putting words on all those things that I could just never put my word, like put my finger on, like just something wasn't right with me. And he was talking about all that kind of stuff, and what got me was he said like what happened to him and what his life was like now, and like that stuff had been removed. And for the first time since I had been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had this hope that I could be happy and sober at the same time. I'm not going to have to go in and out the rest of my life until I die or get locked up for life. And so right after the meeting, I asked him to sponsor me. And he didn't tell me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. He didn't tell me to do whatever other crazy directions I've gotten over the years. He gave me a big book, and he told me to read the doctor's opinion. And I did it. I had nothing on my social calendar. I had nothing, like, no responsibilities at that time. I was living in my mom's basement with a job that I wasn't even showing up for, fresh out of jail. And so I had a lot of time, and it was like that brief window of like my ideas are at bay, my ego is at bay enough that someone can give me some direction, and I'm going to follow it. And I was pretty desperate, you know. Everything that I'd ever tried wasn't working, and so I did what he told me to do. We went through the 12 steps together, and it was just it was definitely powerful. You know, I had everything that the big book described. I had all those promises coming true in my life, and but it doesn't even compare, you know, to the gifts and the relationship that I built with God through passing it on. And I can remember him explaining this, like, you know, the primary purpose of this is becoming fit to pass it on, to help someone else. Because I had absolutely nothing to offer anyone. And I always showed up, you know, trying to take from every situation I was in. And he showed me how to apply these principles in my life and do basically the opposite of everything I was doing my whole life. But I remember the first guy, I don't think anyone asked me to sponsor them for a few months of me doing 12-step work. I just kind of like commandeered them and told them that we're going to do this. And I don't know how effective that was, but it was definitely a cool experience. And I would sit down with guys, and I wasn't even 90 days sober, and I would just call my sponsor, like, all right, what do I do? And then I would like go talk to this new guy, and I'm new myself, but you know, and a lot of times, you know, I get a lot more hope just sitting down listening to a new guy talk about his like fresh experiences with these principles, because there's no ego, there's no like, you know, they heard it from a great, you know, circuit speaker or something like that. They're just sharing their experience with like, this is what's happening. I'm getting my life back, that obsession's at bay, and they're like, you know, in tears just saying like all this hope they have, and that fills me up, and that's what we were doing there. There was no ego, there was no anything. We just two pretty much new guys sharing their experiences, you know, their fresh experiences with these principles, and a lot of cool stuff started to happen. I don't remember when, but that mental obsession was gone. That emptiness was filled. It was like, I don't know when it happened, but I remember when I realized it was happening. I was going to this halfway house, and I kept like picking guys up. My sponsor told me to go and pick guys up and take them to meetings and share your experience with them, that kind of stuff. And I just remember driving home from there one day, just feeling like absolutely like amazed. Like God was just sitting right next to me, and I was not a religious or spiritual person before I got sober, and I just would like, I would just be blown away by like what's going on in my heart and what's going on in my life. I don't know. I just the realization that if I keep doing what I'm doing, I'm never gonna have to live that way again was just amazing, and I would have completely sold myself short to think that that's all this program has to offer. As powerful as that seemed, today it feels like just talking about, you know, this morning's breakfast. It doesn't seem like it has any depth or weight to it, and that's why these principles aren't like once and done things we do and then we move on our merry way. I constantly seek those experiences with these principles, and you know, through the direction of a sponsor and prayer, meditation, and building that relationship with God. I've had, you know, all of the promises come true in my life, and it's funny because I used to always try and like I used to think that if I wanted to be happy, that I was in charge of my own destiny, and that you know, it was going to be the result of my actions and my ideas, and my ideas for being happy were always to pursue the external stuff, And for once, you know, that I put that stuff on the back burner and decided to pursue this. And all of that other external stuff that I'd always tried to have been, like, to be putting together, it finally just started falling into place. Like, my job, like, I didn't know where I was going. I knew what I wanted to do. But I started sponsoring this guy. And he was doing exactly what I decided to go to school for. And right as my schooling was about done, he was moving to California, and I got his job. And it was, and it's like, it's exactly what I've always wanted to do my whole life. I love computers, I love networking, and that's what I do. I have my own computers and networks, and I get to like play with them and do all that kind of geek stuff, and I love it. And none of it was my idea. I didn't have to apply for it. I didn't have to pursue it. And I'm not saying, like, if you do good 12-step work, like, you get jobs. I'm just saying, I'm just, because someone will say, like, hey, I just, like, sponsored my first guy, and where's my job? I'm just saying, like, that kind of stuff never happened for me when I was running my life. And I started, like, turning my will and my life over to the care of God, and stuff like that continued to happen constantly. You know, I also went through a lot of painful stuff in my first year of sobriety. Of course, it had to do with girls or money, and in this case, it was girls. I've been dating this girl for, I don't know, four years. I'd almost a year sober. She got sober with me, but as we started doing this, we kind of like broke onto like different paths, and it was like just like the drink. It was like, I can't imagine living with this girl another day. But I can't imagine living life without her, you know? Because it was all I was used to. It was exactly, it was just comfortable. And I always talk about this just because it seems like once we get sober, we always struggle with those two things, you know, the relationships and the money. And you know, to latch onto those things, there's going to be some pain, and I'm grateful for this experience today, but it was definitely pretty painful. And I wasn't treating her like the kind of guy I want to be, and we're both miserable together, and we started dating other people behind our backs, and it was just insanity, and I feel like a fraud because I'm out there like talking to new guys and talking about spirituality and principles, and I'm at home like treating this girl like crap, And, you know, but at the same time, I'm still, you know, continuing to pray, continuing to try and find a new guy to help, and I'm bringing him home and talking to him and stuff, and one of them catches her eye. So that all goes down, and I'm calling my sponsor just, like, resentful at the world, completely empty. I can't believe it. I'm calling him at, like, 3 in the morning, like, you know, if I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, this wouldn't be happening, because this new guy, she would have never met him. And I just want to go to this halfway house and just, like, beat him up and all this crazy stuff. And that was my idea, like, beat him up. Just beat him up. And what he said was, you know, stuff like this is you're either going to learn and grow from or you know, it's going to kill you. You're going to let it destroy you. And he said, you know, if you want to let it destroy you, you know, just go ahead and do that. You know, you're on probation, you'll be in jail in no time. And he said, but if you want to learn and grow from it, you know, why don't you go over there and tell him that you know what's going on, and that you're still willing to help him if he wants it. And that is not at all what I wanted to hear. So, like, I stay up all night and just watch, like, infomercials and cry about my life. Thinking about how much I just want to quit AA because this is ridiculous. And then I started to think back about, like, all the stuff that was happening in my life. And where I was at a year ago. And how quickly everything had changed. And it was just, like, one of those, like, fork in the roads of my recovery and my relationship with God. And, you know, and I don't know where the willingness came from. And I don't know if I would even have that today. But I was, I that's what I did. I went over there and I told him, and it was just like, it was a really awesome experience. We continued to do the steps, and that resentment was like gone like that. You know, I still had a lot of like pain, you know, but the resentment towards him was gone. And it was just like, it was just an awesome experience. Probably like one of the best like 12-step experiences I've ever had. And it was just like a reaffirmation of the power of these principles. You know, because there was so much resentment and pain on my 4-step that I carry around forever. And then, you know, I do this and it's gone like that. Just by following someone's simple directions. And, you know, it just blew my mind. That first sponsor, you know, shortly after that, he started doing some things that I would find questionable myself, you know, if I were doing today. And he didn't say sober. And my sponsor now always says, you know, be careful how you treat the new guy. He might become your sponsor one day. And that was this guy's case. We started talking again once he got sober, and we went through the steps together. And once again, another one of my favorite 12-step experiences, because when he was my sponsor, I could not find it in myself. You know, he told me, be fearless and thorough on your 4th step. Don't leave anything out. And I left 2 things out. Of course, you know, where was it? You know, on the 3rd page. And I stayed sober, you know, but I still had that stuff going on in here. And the next sponsor I got, I did, you know, write a fearless and thorough inventory and got rid of that kind of stuff. But when we went to do this guy's 5th step, I said, look, you know, I left some things off of my 5th step when we did it, when you were my sponsor, and this is what it is. And then he in turn said, there are some things that I left off on my 5th step with my first sponsor, and it was the same exact 2 things. And it was just like another one of those moments, like, wow, this is like one of those like times where you just feel like this is exactly where I'm supposed to be doing, exactly what I'm supposed to be doing with the person I'm supposed to be doing it with. Just an absolute certainty in my heart that God is here, you know. Not that he's absent anywhere, but it's just like one of those like God shot moments. And I've had so many of those. Recently, like maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I ran into a friend, a friend's ex-girlfriend, and she was saying, like, so-and-so is in prison, and you should write to him. And so, you know, I wrote to him, and we've been talking back and forth, and then, like, a week after that, this lady at work, she was just talking in the break room to seemingly whoever would be listening about her son. And how, you know, he's got all these DUIs, he can't stay sober, he's on heroin, you know, right now he's actually in jail. And so, you know, I pulled her aside and told her a little bit about my past, and we went out to lunch, and, you know, she asked me if I would, you know, talk to him, and so now I was writing to that guy. And then, like, a couple days after that, I was done, like, a bowling match, and my aunt called me, and she said, you know, do you talk to people? Because I think my grandparents had told her, you know, some of the different things that I was doing, you know, with my life today. And she said her best friend's son is in jail, and he's on heroin, and would you talk to him? So that was like, it was just weird. That was like 3, you know, right there. And so I'm like writing all these inmates, and then I go to my credit union last Friday actually. And I used to work there, and so some of the people that work there know my past. And when I got there, one of the loan officers said, "There's someone that works here now that wants to see you." And so she takes me back to this marketing department they have now, and it's my friend's mom that I hadn't seen in like 7 or 8 years, and the people that worked with her had told her about my life, and she, you know, once they realized she was talking about, she said, "You've got to be kidding! Like this is a mistake! Like the wrong person! There's got to be 2 Dan Hamiltons in Lancaster County." And then she told me that to my face, and she said, "You know, I'm pretty sure. Like I thought you were going to be dead or in jail." And so we talked, and she gave me his address. So now I'm writing to 4 people, and once again, it's like when I'm sitting there listening to her, like, I always knew what was about to come out of her mouth, and once again, just one of those God shots where you know you're exactly where you're supposed to be doing exactly what you need to be doing. And I wake up every day asking God for that, you know, not for my will or for anything that I want other than for him to show me what I'm supposed to be doing. And when I'm praying for that, and when I'm, you know, I don't pray for that and wait for some kind of voice to come down from the clouds or to come into my head or something. I pay attention to what's going on around me, you know, because I believe that God is everything and God works through people. And so, you know, when I'm waking up every day and asking for God's will, I'm listening, you know, to what's going on. And when I'm doing that, it becomes pretty apparent, you know, where I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, and I answer my cell phone when someone calls me. And once again, it becomes very apparent, like, for instance, tonight, this is where I'm supposed to be. And it's a pretty easy way of life, you know, because when I was managing my life, it was like, it's a lot of work, you know, because you want everything to go your way, and it just never does, and I would just manage my life into the ground. I had a lot of cool men's experiences. My first one was unplanned, unexpected. I was just at the coffee shop with some, like, you know, fellowship people, and I just talked to my sponsor about my 8-step, so we didn't really talk too much about amends. We were going to, like, you know, go over, like, which ones we should make. And he says, if you run into any of these people, you got to call me. You know, don't just run up in there and ruin everything. This is probably what I would have done. You know, none of these principles were my ideas, or none of these actions I took, you know, in the program were my idea whatsoever. So I ran into the bathroom and called my sponsor at the time. And it was like this kid that I had stolen money out of his locker in gym class. And I knew that, like, I didn't have any other way of getting a hold of him, but, like, here's an opportunity. So I called him, and he told me what to say. And so I went up to this kid and told him, you know, what I was doing. And I gave him, like, the money that I had, which was, like, half. And I told him, you know, if it's okay with you, like, I'll take your phone number and meet up with you to give you the rest of your money. And he gave me a bogus phone number because he thought, like, I was, like, nuts. So I was like, all right, you know, what do you do with that? How do you make the rest of your money? And, like, a few months later, I saw him at the bookstore. And I had enough money on me to give him, and he's just like, what is this kid about? You know, every time he sees me, he starts giving me money. But the funny thing is, since I've been sober, I've only seen him two times, and it was those two times that I had money that I owed him. And it's just like, you know, I don't know if, like, God manages down to that kind of point, but it's just crazy how stuff like that happens. You know, like I said, when I got sober, my family wasn't down with me being anywhere in the vicinity of their house, and today I have keys to their houses, and I can show up and help them out, and they trust me, and we have a great relationship, and they don't have to worry about, you know, things missing out of their house, and they can, you know, trust me with my sister and my stepbrother and sister, and. It's just real cool, and it's great to be able to look them in the eye and not have to worry about what they know is missing from the house or whether or not they know, you know, how wasted I am. But I can just show up and be a son, and Alcoholics Anonymous showed me how to do that. And there's a lot of different things that, you know, people experience throughout sobriety, and you know, death of loved ones is just one of those things. And I kind of, like, you know, carefully avoided somehow dealing with that matter. But you know, my grandpa is, you know, dying in a couple weeks. They gave him, he's got lung cancer, and it's just I'm so glad that, you know, I have the peace in my heart today and the relationship with God today, to not just deal with that so I don't have to feel pain, but to offer. A hand to my family, you know, and show up and be of service, and, you know, be able to talk to them and have something to bring to the table instead of being like a liability while all this stuff is going on. Because I tell you what, if I was, like, not sober, like, they would have to worry about, like, all of the pills in the house and, you know, just all that kind of stuff. But I can go over and see them, and it can be a good experience. And I don't know, my life today is pretty simple, and I get to you know, pursue and experience all the external stuff in my life that I've always liked, but I never put it first. You know, I put this program first, and I get to enjoy all these things. You know, the sports and the stuff that I do with work, and, you know, the relationships and it's awesome. Like, I'm peaceful and content with my life. And, you know, I didn't really think that was possible. I kind of wished when I was sitting in jail that I would either, you know, just be able to stay sober or just have enough alcohol to last me the rest of my life. That's like, if you gave me one wish, it would just be that. Like, just give me like an endless supply, and I'll be happy. I'll be okay. And I would have completely sold myself short. I had no idea what was available for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it has so much more than just staying sober one day at a time. You know, living this spiritual way of life is just incredible. And the next new guy that walks in the door is always going to be my ticket, you know. And that's where it all starts. You know, for me to constantly pursue the next new guy, continue, you know, keeps me praying, keeps me calling my sponsor, keeps me by default pursuing something worldly, and it keeps me sane and happy. And if you're not experiencing that kind of stuff, it is available for everyone without exception, you know, when you take these actions. So, you know, my suggestion to be is to find someone. I saw a lot of happy faces here and a lot of people that'd be willing to help you. And I think that's all I got. Thanks.